cooperate, co-sign, and co-star, co-pilots and co-chairs that we are, and I simply can't hide my bundles of pride that we COVID coalesce from afar. Welcome to Spectrum West, a confinement companion for Western Wisconsin, where for a while more yet, we'll be centered on arts, culture, and resilience. I'm Al Ross. We have some stimulating conversations this week, some designed to address our dilemma head-on, still others meant to divert our attention away from said dilemma. Gary Jones grew up on a farm in the Driftless region of Wisconsin, wrote a book about all of it, people, places, the whole Megillah. He's on the phone, as are all our guests, and even some hosts. Jim Oliver hopped on the phone at his home, called Mary Antoine at hers, and they'll share their conversation about her book, The War of 1812, in Wisconsin, The Battle for Prairie du Chien. It's National Poetry Month, and our first visitor of verse is Thomas R. Smith, the popular River Falls writer with many books and chapbooks to his credit. And this is where and with whom we begin. We've already seen many displays of support, compassion, and empathy during the COVID-19 experience we'll never forget. And another quality we're seeing in healthy numbers is teamwork. It's a concept that several nonprofit organizations not only believe in, but now depend on. A new alliance is Together Chippewa Valley, a circling of the wagons for regional nonprofit organizations who need to protect their ability to serve and, in some cases, their very existence. Carrie Kincaid is coalition spokesperson. We hear daily about the different businesses affected by the global and American pandemic, and it's always been the nonprofit support organizations who come to the aid of those needing it. But this situation is so widespread and inclusive in its influence that the nonprofits themselves are feeling it. As the news release says, quote, facilities have been closed, events and programs canceled, fundraisers postponed or canceled, and expenses incurred as their people work remotely, end of quote. That's the thing about nonprofit organizations. People count on them in exactly times like this. So, because this situation is so widespread, Carrie, fill us in on the concept.
I was invited to be the spokesperson for a small, creative, energetic effort called Together Chippewa Valley. The idea came from a couple of the larger nonprofits who wanted to help out other nonprofits in a quick way. It's so important that we remember, as you outlined, that nonprofits are sometimes the silent infrastructure in keeping a community going. You also mentioned that this is a response to a global effort, but when people feel rather overwhelmed by something as large as a global pandemic, sometimes the best thing they can do to help them feel humane is to respond locally.
Sure.
And that's what this group did, and responded quickly and locally and concentrated on the needs of nonprofits.
You use the word small to describe this impetus. I have a feeling that it's not going to remain small because it's a wonderful idea.
I'm just delighted to be asked to be part of it. They got together and did so much groundwork, wrote up an MOU, and then asked me to help them, which, of course, I'm happy to do. There is room for growth. People can join as a nonprofit up until April 10th. And as of this morning, there are 7 more groups waiting for the board meeting. So we would be somewhere around 15 organizations joining this little effort. So in the global world, that is small, but sure, in our world, that's not small.
So you get to double figures and you're you're there. I should point out that the release that gave me word that this was happening came out last Thursday. You and I are talking on Monday, and the release itself, when I read it, felt open-ended, but it has proven that. The original people who were involved in the formation of this, Boys and Girls Clubs of the Greater Chippewa Valley, the Chippewa Valley Museum, the Children's Museum of Eau Claire, the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild, the Eau Claire County Humane Association, the Family Resource Center, Junior Achievement of Wisconsin, and the Pablo Center at the Confluence. All very familiar names. 224 years combined service to the community. They serve 194,000 people annually. They employ 249 people, generate nearly $8 million in economic impact annually for the community, purchase almost $2 million in goods and services locally each year. There you go. That's a heavyweight list. The seven more who are waiting.
Together Chippewa Valley has an executive board. There is a little approval, a process, signing of a memorandum of understanding. So as soon as that is complete, there will be seven more organizations in that list.
And you and I, as I said, are recording on Monday. This show will air on Thursday. So what we'll do during the live portion is update the people who have joined. We're on the phone with Carrie Kincaid. Together Chippewa Valley. It's a nonprofit coalition. It's new. And I guess if anything can be exciting during the situation we're in, it's exciting. We'll watch it grow. Carrie, you've been involved at several official levels in Eau Claire over the years, including city government. Eau Claire has met and overcome challenges before, but this one feels different because other than safeguards in place and suggested, there's a certain vulnerability here that's novel, and that's a word that applies to the virus itself. How about it for you personally and maybe on a professional level? Does, when something like this happen, a certain responsibility mode kick in for you? Is it kind of innate? Is it part of who you are?
I could see in those years being a public servant that the responsibility is great. One is happy to rise to that occasion because you can see what a little bit of work done by a lot of people who really care can do for a community. Mm-hmm. I saw that, of course, for 14 years as city staff, and they applied their best effort to solving problems. This effort appeals to me particularly because it is so broad-based, which is where I am used to working. Local government is, by its definition, a broad-based coalition. This big effort paints a broad brush across the organizations that are involved. It offers something local government is not maybe that good at, and that is being a nimble coalition. Mm. It came together quickly. A website was donated. People who are used to working in nonprofits got together, wrote out an MOU, and here we have a nimble and a quick response. I find that extremely attractive and effective. It reflects what I've come to know in the Chippewa Valley as practical, get down and do the work sort of response to helping out each other. And I just find that this effort exemplifies that part of us that we're all so accustomed to.
So knowing Eau Claire and the area as well as you do, how does Carrie Kincaid see us coming out of this as far as lessons learned and being more nimble, as you alluded a moment ago? Will we be better Girl and Boy Scouts, more prepared? How do you think we're going to do after this is in the rear view mirror?
I've thought about that a lot as I have family spread all over the United States. So I'm keenly aware of the response as far as it affects my family. My husband and I live in Eau Claire, obviously, and so we think from this grounding. We think about all of them out there and how they are living through their own response in their community. I have compared it a little bit to Eau Claire and what I know of her so well. I think it's possible that we will capitalize on what we already are, which I referred to often as a city that works. Kind of nose to the grindstone, be practical, watch out for your neighbor. I think that part of us will strengthen. We will see that there's a value in this response that we have watched each other go through. This morning, I was walking my dog. I met two people that I know from the neighborhood. Without even saying anything, we just went around each other, stopped to have a conversation, and wished each other well, of course, and caught up. And then we moved on, having been enriched by that little conversation, confident that other people are respectful of what we need to do. It's heartwarming. But I think on top of that sort of a city that works, if we have the energy, we may ask ourselves, well, what else? What else can we be? And I think this little project may be an answer to that. We can take all that hard work and all that stuff and say, oh, well, let's just try something. And let's put this together, use what we know, use our talents, trying out a few things across interests, across economic sectors, across race, across gender, across everything.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
maybe it'll push us a little bit to be the best of what we already are.
As I saw this thing coming together, I thought, all right, so they're banding together to consolidate. Will they find new avenues of cooperation going forward? And I have a feeling that will happen more than just fundraising. They will maybe be real good at spirit raising and and cooperating. Okay, so you are the spokesperson for Together Chippewa Valley. And I can't think of anything more important to speak about than giving people the specifics on how they can help.
You bet. Donations of any amount are welcome and are available for online giving at togetherchippewavalleyoneword.org. There also is a mailing address, and I don't have it in front of me right now, but Visit Eau Claire is our fiscal agent. People can mail checks to Visit Eau Claire, located in the Palo Center at the Confluence.
128 Graham Avenue.
Thank you for that.
Sure.
There's work processing the donations, and they've donated to the effort. So that's another way of just showing that we can just put away some rules once in a while and help each other.
Yeah, good stuff. And it'll go forward even when the sun comes back up. Carrie Kincaid, thanks so much for being with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio and specifically Spectrum West. Keep us in the loop.
I will.
Thank you, Carrie.
You're welcome, Mel.
Turns out there are six new collaborators in the effort. The YMCA of the Chippewa Valley, the Community Table, Fierce Freedom, Bob's House for Dogs, the Girl Scouts, Northwest Great Lakes, and UCP, West Wisconsin. Obviously, the cumulative effort we feel has also grown, but it's who's participating that's most important, because helping is our focus. Yes, way to go. Together, Chippewa Valley. Coming up, a couple of Wisconsin-based books, and next, poetry has its month. This is Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank, offering fixed-rate mortgages, bridge loans, construction loans, and more. Loan officers Dawn and Susie are dedicated to providing personalized service. CharterBank.bank, invested in partnerships. Support also comes from Marquardt Toyota, committed to providing an enjoyable and stress-free buying process for almost 50 years with welcoming facilities and personalized service. Details are at MarquardtToyota.com. It is National Poetry Month, and if in the midst of everything else going on, you remembered that, good for you, because it's one of those things, poetry, that we should hold on to and allow to grant us respite from the news of the day, don't you think? Thomas R. Smith resides in River Falls and is a poet, several books to his name. He's the first of several poets we hope to feature while enduring April 2020. We spoke by phone earlier this week. Happy National Poetry Month.
Oh, yeah.
That's got to be something that excites guys like you.
Under normal circumstances, that would be true, but just about everything I had on the calendar has been canceled, so it's a kind of a low-keyed one this year.
You transitioned then. Yeah, there's a lot of things going on. In fact, we'll talk about an emergency fund in River Falls for people who have appearances and gigs canceled. What does a poet do when he or she finds nothing on the calendar?
Well, I think we generally these days are resorting to the digital world, and one thing that that I'm involved with right now is I started a renga, which is a style of Japanese linked poetry, with a group of friends of mine scattered mostly around the Twin Cities area. The rules of this linked poem is that you write a three-line verse, which is almost identical in form to the haiku, and then you send it on to the next person, and they associate from that, and they write a two-line verse that's traditionally seven syllables, and then it goes to the next person, and they write a a 5-7-5 verse, and then the next person writes a 7-7 verse, and on and on and on, as long as you feel like it. This form was actually in vogue in Japan for hundreds of years, which is hard for us to imagine, but it was a favorite activity among poets, and I can imagine them sitting around for a weekend around the sake bottle or the teapot, you know, just writing very, very long linked verses, sometimes into the thousands of stanzas. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to go that far, but this is a good thing for poets to do in the absence of in-person poetic activity.
I knew that you guys would come up with something clever. And you know what? The old chain letter, you know, that lost its shine years ago. They got to just be a pain in the butt. People didn't like them, and then someone didn't continue them. But maybe this whole thing will bring back the allure of the chain letter. And you have a chain poem going on.
That's right. We're currently on our second round among the 10 people participating. So who knows how long this will go on.
Are you going to publish it sometime?
Hard to tell.
You got to give a lot of credits.
That's right. It's got to be good, too. That's the sticker, and these things often have very weak spots in them, but so far we're doing pretty good.
Well, we're going to have you read whatever you have sitting there in front of you, things that you have written, I suppose, in response to what's been going on. But tell me first, what's easier, writing during bad times or writing during good times? I kept thinking, and maybe we've talked about this before, the inspiration to write something. I would think a poet has to feel something before he or she decides to put it on paper or into their computer, and obviously we're all feeling something right now.
Well, I'm reminded of something that the poet Donald Hall once said. He said, "The happy poem sleeps in the sun," by which he meant that happiness doesn't generate poetry as much as difficulty and conflict and tension and misery. I think we're all in that tension, conflict, misery boat right now. Poets are getting pretty busy, at least on paper, if not, you know, out in the open mics.
There'll probably be some real award winners coming out of this thing.
You know, I think in a strange way, we're going to see some flourishing of the arts right now, because the creation of art requires a certain amount of solitude, and we're all under house arrest right now by solitude. So, I expect to see, you know, some memorable products coming out from our novelists, our songwriters, our poets, dancers, theater people.
Yeah, I was even thinking visual artists not having enough time to do new stuff. But, man, after this, we are going to have some marvelous stockpiles.
I think so.
Yeah,
so we've got nothing if not time right now.
Right. No excuses.
No excuses. That's right. This is where the pedal hits the metal, man.
Thomas R. Smith on the phone with us, River Falls poet. It's National Poetry Month. People aren't really celebrating in the normal way, but they are writing, and they are writing about the situation that we're in. Thomas, I read in a release, the River Falls Community Arts Base, of which you're very familiar, I'm sure, has established an emergency relief fund for artists living and working in Pierce or St. Croix counties.
That's terrific. That's a great thing.
They do nice stuff.
Yeah, that's the right kind of response right now to the times.
The fund was seeded with some money from the CAB budget, and CAB members and community members are welcome to make donations to add to the fund. Additionally, CAB will devote all money raised from Give Big SCV in 2020 to further support emergency funding for artists. Here's the nuts and bolts of it. Applications can be found on the website riverfallscab.org/emergency-fund. So there you go.
It's heartening, too, how much good is really being done by people, just ordinary people right now. And
yeah.
I think I read in an editorial in the Minneapolis Star Tribune that all of the dire predictions of savagery and disorder and lawlessness under these circumstances has not come to pass. We've really shown our true colors as people and helped each other and been, you know, real neighbors and real friends. So I think that's a heartening takeaway from this time, and I think that's something that we can carry forward into the future a long ways.
Yeah, but the cynic in me says, give it time.
Oh, yeah.
You want savagery, give it a little more time. No.
Yeah, well, you know, know, we get, you know, climate collapse, and then we'll see what happens. But hopefully this will sound a warning shot. Against that, too, I mean, this present shutdown that we're seeing right now is probably nothing compared to what happens if there's a reversible worldwide climate collapse. So yeah. This is another lesson we can take away from this and start thinking hard about facing the future.
My fingers are crossed that we learn the lesson.
Me too.
You said, and you were right, that people like you are writing things in response to the situation you're in, or were in. You sent me a poem. It's called Laughter in the Dark. Do you have that?
I hate to say this, but I don't have a clean copy of that in front of me.
Maybe.
I've got almost everything else. But
maybe I should read it.
I don't have that one. Yeah, maybe you should. You know, this is like a cover version. You know, they have covers in music. Why not covers in poetry?
Nah, I don't feel right. I don't feel worthy, let's put it that way. So Laughter
That's
in the Dark.
Totally undeserved unworthiness, you know.
Yeah, well, Laughter in the Dark's going to have to wait. What do you have for us? Response to what it is. You're sitting in your quiet chair and you say, I got to write something. Here it comes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've approached this from a few different angles, and I think this is the one that I'm finding most satisfying right now. It's called the loneliness. Because that was one of the first things I noticed. My wife was recovering from a stroke, still is. And as a matter of fact, she was in rehab at a local care facility, Kinnick. At a certain point, they were locked down, and we couldn't see each other, except I'd go around to the outdoor window of her room and tap on it, and we'd talk through the glass with difficulty. And I started to think, wow, how lonely this situation is going to be if it keeps going on. So here we go.
Okay.
The loneliness. Already a vast loneliness has seeped into our souls with the cancellations and closings. We miss the conviviality of the restaurant table, the church service, the joy of the jamming musicians, the natural camaraderie of sidewalk and supermarket. We're not meant to be alone, not meant to deflect the approach of neighbors. Now each locked-down house becomes a grave where small dismembered pieces of community lie scattered alive, waiting to be called back to wholeness. We ache for each other. We ache for contact. We knew it would all break down someday. Not sustainable. The center cannot hold. We are being shown something big. We are being called to something higher. Shall we come out of this changed, finally able to hear each other's voices across the social distance, the voices drowned out by fear? When the theaters and bars reopen, when the hospital beds are vacant again, and the world resumes its old business of getting and spending, how shall we think on these days, withdrawn from one another and the communal heart, the dead civic air? Will the grief still eat at us, as it does now? Is this how it happens, a lesson we need to learn, overshadowing all our other learning? In the enforced quiet, we have space to ask these questions and listen for answers. How will we love each other and ourselves in the upheavals to come?
See, that's the kind of stuff that during National Poetry Month we celebrate.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for that.
That was wonderful. I am featuring a bunch of poets during this month. Max Garland coming up. We have Bruce Taylor coming up. Depending on how long this thing lasts, you'll have volumes, I have a feeling. Are you trying to write something every day, or what are you doing?
Well, I don't have the excuse for not writing every day. I'm not sure I'm quite living up to that, but the journal pages have been filling, let's put it that way.
So that answers my final question. Longhand in a journal, is that what you do? Is that the way you like to write, or do you sit at a computer sometimes, most of the time? How do you do it?
Oh, I like to get my body in it as much as possible, so, you know, sitting at my old oak library table with my notebook and my pen and cup of tea, that's the way I roll.
Thomas R. Smith, thanks as always for being with us.
Thank you, Al. You're doing us a real service here. We appreciate you more than even before with the way public radio is keeping us informed and, you know, keeping us connected. You're You're pure gold.
Well, thanks. You read that just the way I wrote it.
All right. You send the check.
I will. Thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
Yes, you too.
That's fun. By the way, we added Lemoyne McLaughlin to our list of poets to be featured in April. We're excited about that. Down the road on Spectrum West, an autobiographical account of boyhood days on Pleasant Ridge, and we'll say so long to one of the best songwriters of a generation, many say all time. But first, hey, don't worry if your recollection of learning about the War of 1812 does not include it spilling into Wisconsin. I'm not sure many history classes covered that part. So Jim Oliver is going to bring us up to speed from home and see if you can presume where his guest is as well.
When thinking about the events of the War of 1812 today, many Americans can recount how the British burned the White House. And we can also remember that Francis Scott Key wrote the words to the national anthem while watching the British attack Fort McHenry in Baltimore. And they might even hum a tune about the Battle of New Orleans. But the War of 1812 was fought on many fronts, the Atlantic Ocean, on the Great Lakes in Canada, and along the upper Mississippi River. The latter has received the least attention in U.S. history. But then along came a book, The War of 1812 in Wisconsin, The Battle for Prairie du Chien by Mary Elise Antoine. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm going to just ask you to talk about the history of Prairie du Chien. I went to your Facebook page and cheated a little bit. You are a native of Prairie.
Yes, I was born and raised in Prairie du Chien, the second oldest community in the state of Wisconsin, the oldest community in the upper Mississippi River Valley. It was a wide open prairie with a very large island to the west. Both the prairie and the island were traditional gathering places for the Native American tribes. They would gather there. It was always a place where if there were any hostilities, those would be put aside. And so they used the prairie as a place to gather and also to trade with one another. But once the fur trade era started, the Europeans, and at that point it would be mainly the French, also came to realize the importance of the prairie. The French were the first Europeans to see the area with Marquette and Joliet. So after Joliet, there were other fur trader adventurers that came here, Nicolas Perrot. He, in time, built a fortified trading post, which he called Fort St. Nicholas. His other fort, the Trempealeau, is probably better known. He and then other French who came here for the fur trade built, they called them forts, but they were really sort of fortified trading places. Nothing exists anymore. They're just all archaeological sites. But they realized the importance of the prairie, and so it was always a gathering place in the fall when they came with their trade goods, and then again in the spring with the pelts. So the French used the prairie when the fur trade was taken over by the British. And so, again, there was this constant use of the prairie as a important spot in the fur trade. Nobody permanently settled here yet, but in time, Americans came up from what was called the Illinois country. So the prairie became a very important place, and settlement finally began here in the 1770s, just prior to the American Revolution. And at some point, somebody named the prairie La Prairie du Chien, Prairie of the Dog, and we've never been able to determine what the dog was. Was it a person? Was it a clan? We're not too sure.
She is Mary Elise Antoine, who is author of The War of 1812 in Wisconsin, The Battle for Prairie du Chien. On June 18, 1812, U.S. President James Madison signed a declaration of war against Great Britain, which became known as the War of 1812. The issues that led to the declaration were many, but they were also regional in nature. What brought the conflict to Wisconsin?
Who was going to control the land and who was going to control the fur trade?
Uh-huh.
As of the end of the American Revolution, all the land east of the Mississippi, except for Florida, belonged to the United States. And so this was all U.S. territory, but the United States, after the American Revolution, basically disbanded their army. So even though the United States had all this Northwest Territory, they really couldn't enforce anything. And the British had traded here before. They had good relations with the residents, both French-speaking and Native Americans. So they just continued operating the fur trade. A lot of money went up to Canada instead of to the United States. And the United States wanted to gain the wealth of the fur trade, yet at the same time, they also wanted to gain the land that was available, beautiful, fertile land. So when President Madison declared war on Great Britain, one of the reasons was control of what's now the Northwest Territory.
The Battle of Prairie du Chien was a three-day siege, according to what I read.
Prairie du Chien is positioned at the confluence of the Wisconsin and Mississippi Rivers. By 1812, William Clark of Lewis and Clark fame said whoever controlled Prairie du Chien controlled the upper Mississippi. And he was absolutely correct. The British controlled Prairie du Chien, so they controlled the upper Mississippi. So Clark started lobbying the War Department to allow him to build a fort at Prairie du Chien. Because he said, if we can control Prairie du Chien, not only can we control the upper Mississippi, we can then go from Prairie du Chien up to Green Bay and capture that community. And then we can go from Green Bay to Mackinac Island and capture the British fort there. The War Department sort of didn't give Clark an answer yes or no. So in the spring of 1814, William Clark decided he was going to take matters into his own hands. He put together a force. They came up the Mississippi River from St. Louis to Prairie du Chien, disembarked on the Big Island, and there he had a fort built. He left a barge that also had gunpowder and munitions and cannon and food and everything on it to support the fort, and then he and the rest of the soldiers left. Well, the majority of the residents of Prairie du Chien were engaged in the fur trade with Great Britain, and the residents knew that if the United States gained control of this land, that was the end of the fur trade, the end of their livelihood, and the Native Americans knew that if the United States gained Prairie du Chien, that would be the end of their land. And so the residents of Prairie du Chien, Green Bay, Mackinac Island, and then all the Native American tribes supported the British. And so when Clark built the fort here, the British put together a force beginning in Mackinac Island, continuing to Green Bay, and then up the Fox, down the Wisconsin, to Prairie du Chien, and lay siege to the American fort.
Well, the Treaty of Ghent ended the War of 1812. Did anybody gain anything from the conflict and the subsequent treaty?
No. Everything was to go back to the status that it was prior to the declaration of war. Great Britain had originally put some points to protect the Native Americans, but the United States wouldn't go along with that. The British commander at the fort in Prairie du Chien said, well, this fort wasn't here prior to the war, so therefore withdrew the troops, withdrew the supplies, and set fire to the fort.
So what happened after that then to Prairie du Chien?
Well, Prairie du Chien was still considered to be of great importance. The War Department decided to put together a chain of forts in the western Great Lakes and upper Mississippi. You had Fort Mackinac, Fort Dearborn at what's now Chicago, Fort Armstrong at Rock Island, Fort Howard at Green Bay, and Fort Crawford at Prairie du Chien. A few years later, built Fort Snelling at the confluence of the Minnesota and Mississippi Rivers. Prairie du Chien became part of this chain of forts to gain control and secure the friendship of the native peoples. A fort existed at Prairie du Chien until the 1850s, but the prairie maintained its importance through the Civil War. The first railroad in Wisconsin went from Lake Michigan, Milwaukee, to the Mississippi River, Prairie du Chien. And there was a major steamboat landing here. There were prospects that it was going to turn into a huge community.
There's still a popular tourist attraction.
Very much so. There's a wonderful state park, Wyalusing State Park. Right across in Iowa is Pikes Peak State Park. Zebulon Pike came to Prairie du Chien before he went out west. He was never on the peak out in Colorado. And then just north of Prairie du Chien on the Iowa side is Effigy Mounds National Monument. The area is just beautiful.
We've been talking to Mary Elise Antoine, author of The War of 1812 in Wisconsin, The Battle for Prairie du Chien, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press and is available from the publisher, the usual online suspects, and I'm sure your local bookseller. Thanks very much for your insights and your help and your most interesting book.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed speaking with you.
And thank you, Jim Oliver, as usual. This is Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Pablo Center at the Confluence in Eau Claire, committed to the well-being of the community. More information about rescheduled or postponed performances and special events is available at pablocenter.org. Support also comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona, from Washington Crossing, Delaware, to Audubon and Monet, dedicated to having something for everyone. Great art inspired by water, mmam.org. Well, Gary Jones got to grow up in a place at a time, the likes of which have been settings for movies and TV shows depicting family life during simpler times. He shares his younger years with all of us in the book Ridge Stories, Herding Hens, Powdering Pigs, and Other Recollections from a Boyhood in the Driftless, as in the region of Wisconsin near Richland Center. I enjoyed the book and our conversation. Gary, even in normal times, the mental picture is nice, but in the middle of a worldwide pandemic, a place called Pleasant Ridge sounds more like heaven than ever. Some of us, including me, have gone back to the home where we spent our formative years. Almost always, it just doesn't seem as big, etc. How does Pleasant Ridge of the 21st century look compared to when you were there every day?
The part of it that's smaller, the buildings, the Pleasant Ridge Church seems tiny now. The one-room school that I used to attend is equally tiny. But the ridge itself seems more expansive in some ways because in the interest of keeping roads clear of snow and avoiding power outages, the banks have been graded smooth and the brush and trees have been removed. And there's much more of an open feeling now. I own land on the farm, acreage, and I like to visit that. I like to walk that. I like to watch the land being worked. And I still have an uncle, patriarch of our family, who is in his mid-90s and still lives on Pleasant Ridge, and I visit him and my cousins there periodically.
It's been a while since I read the book, and I normally take notes if I'm going to speak with the author. I did not do that this time. As I read it, it was so memorable, I figured I wouldn't forget. But thankfully, I did put some little sticky markers at points in the book I wanted to recall. One of the pleasant things about the book are the chapters. I'm one who loves short chapters. It makes me feel like I'm getting somewhere. And when your eyes are getting heavy at night, you know you can finish the one that you're reading before turning off the lamp. So thank you for that. That format, I'm guessing, lent itself to storytelling.
But what had happened is that when I first wrote the book, I was thinking in terms of something that would be more chronological. I'm a very young boy on the ridge, and now I'm an old man. But life is not necessarily chronological. Life tends to be more random than that. And ultimately, I hit upon this organization as something that worked really very well. So each piece could be somewhat contained. As my editor said, the book has several points of entry. You can read the last piece before you read the first piece, and it's fine. If there's a general sense of progression throughout the book, I mean, in a general sort of way, but it certainly is not specifically chronological.
Uh-huh. Gary, you lived within a ringing bell of grandparents and other relatives and some neighbors who one simply does not forget. You have chapters whose titles are just names: Edna, Ida, Charlotte, Minnie and May, Steve Bryant, Silas Breeze, Uncle Jake, Victor. How do those people fit into the guy that Gary Jones became as an adult? Is there a little bit of all of them inside you somewhere?
Yes. Absolutely, and I feel a connection with those people. My wife also was a farm girl. She was raised near Platteville. And what I would mention, people like Leonard Turnipseed, for example, she would shake her head and say, we never had people with names like that, or Banjo Schaefer. And I realized when I was a young man, there was a uniqueness to the place where I was raised. My relatives tended to be not particularly sophisticated people. That doesn't mean that they were stupid. That doesn't mean that people should look down on them and feel sorry for them. But they were interesting people. They had complex lives that were close to the earth, and I liked that. And a part of what happened to me, too, is that I knew from the time that I was very young that I did not want to be a farmer. But yet, at the same time, farm life really engaged me. I think one of the reasons that I wrote the book is because of the ambivalence that I feel toward that experience. There's a part of it that's wonderful and engaging and formative and all of those positive sorts of things. And then there's another part of it that makes me uncomfortable, that tells me this is not how I want to live. I recognize the hard life many of my relatives had, my father and grandfather and my uncle. Farm life was much different then, much harder.
That's the voice of Gary Jones. He's the author of the book Ridge Stories, Herding Hens, Powdering Pigs, and Other Recollections from a Boyhood in the Driftless. And I read the book, loved it. Earlier in our conversation, you brought up your one-room schoolhouse, and schools like that are legendary, and people who can talk about the experience are getting fewer and farther between. Given a different decade, you could have swapped sandwiches with John Boy and Jim Bob.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. And what is interesting is you remember the Baldwin sisters?
You bet.
On that program? We had the Woodman sisters. They were similar in so many ways to the Baldwin sisters that it was almost haunting when I first watched that program, that series.
Was that the Minnie and the May?
No, I didn't include them in the book. The thing is, I could probably write two or three more books.
Well, then, go ahead.
If there were interest in that. No.
Well, we're looking forward to them then. Well,
it would be fun. It would be fun to do.
We're standing in line, waiting.
Well, thank you.
Good. Have you had any reunions over the years with people? Have you gone back to Pleasant Ridge?
I see my uncle fairly regularly, and
sure.
I have cousins.
But how about school? School reunions? Have you gone
school
back?
School reunions? And... Yes. This last summer, coincidentally, we had a reunion at the Lloyd School. Part of my schooling was at the Pleasant Ridge School during the early years, and the latter part was at the Wheat Hollow School. So it was a combined Pleasant Ridge Wheat Hollow reunion, you know, in this old school that is now a community building. And
sure.
It was absolutely wonderful. Here we were, all these old people wandering around, trying to recognize one another and recalling those experiences that we had, and amazed to see the different directions that our lives have taken. So it was really fine. It was really wonderful.
You perfectly described every reunion that I've been to.
One of the interesting things is that when you go to reunions, you know, you find that your classmates look more like their parents and grandparents than the way they looked when they were just kids.
Exactly. What have you heard from readers? I'm guessing that people have come out of the woodwork and said, man, you described my childhood to a T, and thank you so much for writing it. And
I've received that comment often. I've had people who are strangers who tell me that I've written their life stories, in a sense. It's always satisfying when I hear that. I have other people, too, who tell me, people that know me, say that when they read my book, it's as if we're talking, as if we're having a conversation, and they feel engaged in that way. And that makes me feel really very, very pleased, because after all, the whole point of writing a book or writing anything is to make connections with other people.
Mm-hmm.
When you make those connections, that's a very satisfying thing to do.
A book is a wonderful legacy, and grandchildren are a blessing for many reasons, but speaking of legacies, they are the messengers who will keep those stories alive, and that must make you feel good, because you have those next generations. They're appreciative of your stories, I bet.
Yes. I dedicate my book both to my wife, who was very instrumental in my writing for years and years, and then also my granddaughter, Julia, who is now 5 and a half. I had a rather acrimonious relationship with my grandfather.
Yes.
I was not the grandchild that he really wanted. I mean, we did okay. You know, we never injured one another, you know, physically or I think seriously, emotionally. But there was always a tension there. When I found out we were going to have a grandchild, I was asked, what do you want your grandchild to call you? And without even thinking about it, I said, Graham. Huh? And that was my grandfather, Graham. So that sort of encapsulates the ambivalence that I have felt toward my, my experiences. They were very important. But at the same time, when I described them, I tried not to romanticize my experience, not to get sympathy from people in any way or not to make people angry. But I didn't want this to be a Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm kind of experience. I wanted people to know what it really was like and that that's okay.
Yeah, good for you. Well, those of us who have read the book appreciate the fact that you opened up your soul and told us, you know, all of the ins and outs, good stuff and not so good stuff about your life as a kid in the Driftless region. And I urge people, and I'm holding it in my left hand, to get Ridge Stories by Gary Jones. I intentionally, Gary, did not want to give away too much about the book. Thank you for alluding to some of the stories in it, but... I'd like it to be a pleasant, using your word, surprise. So where can we get the book? All over?
Pretty much all over. A number of libraries in Wisconsin carry my book, so if you don't necessarily have to shell out $20 to read my book, you can check it out at a library. But there are also a number of bookstores that carry the book, and then, of course, like everything, is available on Amazon.com.
Given the situation that we're in now, with all these questions going on, this is a wonderful time to read this book because you can get lost in it and take the edge off reality, the way it's said. So I urge people to pick up the book, take a break, get away from words like COVID and pandemic and enjoy hearing about Gary Jones' younger days. Gary, thanks so much for being with us here on Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay safe with you and the family, and please keep in touch because those subsequent books.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed talking with you very much. It's always fun to talk about my book, and I thank you for having me as your guest.
This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. John Prine died Tuesday. He was 73. Complications from the virus that has the entire world in a tailspin. Described as among the English language's premier phrase turners with music relevant to any age. He emerged in 1970 at a time when people were said to be searching for a new or another Dylan, although if you've listened to his latest release, Murder Most Foul, you'll realize there will never be another Bob Dylan. But likewise, John Prine also cannot and will not be replaced. From his final album, The Tree of Forgiveness, this is When I Get to Heaven.
When I get to heaven, I'm going to shake God's hand, thank him for more blessings than one man can stand. Then I'm going to get a guitar and start a rock and roll band. Check into a swell hotel. Ain't the afterlife grand? And then I'm going to get a cocktail, vodka and ginger ale. Yeah, I'm going to smoke a cigarette that's 9 miles long. I'm gonna kiss that pretty girl on the tilt-a-whirl, cause this old man is going to town. Then as God is my witness, I'm getting back into show business. I'm gonna open up a nightclub called the Tree of Forgiveness and forgive everybody ever done me any harm. Why, I might even invite a few choice critics, those syphilitic parasitics. Buy them a pint of Smithix and smother them with my charm. Cause then I'm gonna get a cocktail, vodka and ginger ale. Yeah, I'm gonna smoke a cigarette that's 9 miles long. I'm gonna kiss that pretty girl on the tilt-a-whirl. Yeah, this old man is going to town. Ba-da-ba-da-ba. Ba-da-da-ba-da-ba. Yeah, when I get to heaven, I'm gonna take that wristwatch off my arm. What are you gonna do with time after you bought the farm? And then I'm gonna go find my mom and dad. And good old brother Doug, well, I bet him and cousin Jackie are still cutting up a rug. I wanna see all my mama's sisters, cause that's where all the love starts. I miss them all like crazy, bless their little hearts. And I always will remember these words my daddy said. He said, buddy, when you're dead, you're a dead peckerhead. I hope to prove him wrong, that is, when I get to heaven. Cause I'm gonna have a cocktail, vodka and ginger ale. Yeah, I'm gonna smoke a cigarette that's 9 miles long. I'm gonna kiss that pretty girl on the tilt-a-whirl. Yeah, this old man is going to town. Yeah, this old man is going to town.
Mr. John Prine. Wow. Hey, Spectrum West will continue to shape itself week to week around current issues while also creating listening diversions, because life goes on, and we want to remind you of that. Coming up next week, a visit to a studio where a stunning new public piece of art is being created. Poetry Month continues. Special guest Max Garland will be here. And more. Here's a quick Spectrum memo. The 6th annual Blue Ox Music Festival has rescheduled its original June 11th to 13th dates to August 27th to 29th, taking place at Whispering Pines Campground in Eau Claire. Details, blueoxmusicfestival.com online. Thanks for being part of our audience. Thank you for doing your part in what needs doing. Thanks to Dean, Kate, Catherine, Jim. Live safe, be smart. Looking forward to seeing you next week.